You're now diving into the fish tank.
Sitting down with Seth Living, Seth. OJ, Juice Man, ooh, and this is strictly for them true fans, yeah. Dog fans, number one. Of course, y'all, this ain't no ordinary sports talk. Dive up in that fish tank.
Welcome back to the Fish Tank right here in the Miami Dolphins Podcast Network. Seth Levitt with my main man, OJ McDuffie. Juice, how you feeling today?
What's up, Big Seth?
Loving life today. Preach, everything's good?
Everything's good, man.
Well, we got a little sneak peek behind you there of today's guest. Juice, the people have spoken.
Right.
And the man answered. We had to call. It was like trying to get in touch with a president, or I had to go through PR guys and trying numbers that I didn't know if they still worked and checking the last time I responded to a text. But we found him. Ricky Williams. Run, Ricky, run right into the tank. How you doing, Rick?
I'm great. I'm really loving life right now. I know there's a lot of difficult things going on, but I've really taken the opportunity to go inwards and work on myself.
That's
kind of a common theme forever with you, man. You've always been that kind of guy.
But now I have a good excuse.
Okay. Fair. That's fair.
You know, R-Dub, you know, Seth and I, you know, we're talking before the show about, you know, how we felt a lot of pressure with this one. There's a lot of pressure coming because, you know, when you were in Miami, you know, you held some of the reporters up to really high standard down here in Miami. And you even called some of them out for asking lazy-ass questions, you know? So
Yes.
So we're going to take the easy road. We're going to go and talk a little bit more about your personal endeavors, you know, including your new project, Leela. And what we want to do first is just talk about what a day in the life of Ricky Williams is these days. Tell us a little bit about what's going on with you.
Yeah, well, I mean, so I'll say like pre-corona stuff, and then I'll kind of talk about what's going on now. So before all this went down, after I left Miami, I kind of piddled around trying to figure out, you know, what am I going to do with my life after football? And my mom kept nagging me to go back to school. She kept saying, you know, you told me you graduated. And so I said, fine, I'll go back to school. And so, and plus I started coaching, and in order to take coaching to the next level, I needed to get my degree. And so I said, I'll just go back to school. So went back to Texas, and within 2 weeks of being back in class, you know, I realized that, damn, this is fun. You know, I could do this for a long time. And I really, really got into school and really started to appreciate the opportunity that I totally missed the first time around about the access to brilliant minds. And I would grew up a little bit playing football, so I had a better idea of what do I want to do with my life, and realizing I have access to these brilliant minds to help, you know, build up my mind and set me on the right path. And so I went back to Texas and I had a blast and I learned so much, and I realized, you know, I want to go to the next level and get a master's degree or a PhD. And so after I finally graduated from Texas, I found a Chinese medicine acupuncture program out in LA, and I moved to LA and started going to school, getting a master's degree. And at the same time, I have a deep interest in psychology. And so I started another master's degree in psychology. I started an herbal wellness company, and just recently announced that I'm launching a dating app, and I'm an astrologer. So I have my own personal practice. And so I'm just really busy. And, you know, it was funny, a couple months ago, I was telling myself, like, I love all the things that I'm doing, but I could really use a couple minutes to take a couple deep breaths and slow down a little bit.
What do you do in your spare time?
I study. I mean, I'm really a big nerd. And I think this is I'm sure OJ can speak to this. This is a big issue that when you're a professional football player, like, it requires a lot of energy and a lot of focus to go through a season. And so
unlike a singular thing, right, Rick?
Yeah. So we have all this energy that we're used to putting towards something. And when we're done playing, you know, at least for me, I had to keep finding things to put that energy towards.
Right.
And I had to keep being productive. And it's hard because, you know, I was one of the best football players in the world, and having to start over at ground zero of trying to build myself with something else, because we have a hunger for greatness, you know? And so I feel so fortunate that I found enough things to devote myself to where I can continue to work towards excellence and help my life stay meaningful. And so since past couple of months, I took this time to really, you know, reinvigorate my daily meditation practice, and to focus on Lilo, you know, and a chance to catch up on my reading. You know, when you're only doing things for school, you lose the appreciation of actually learning something. And so being able to use this time to slow down and go back over all the stuff that I've been studying the past couple of years and get ready, because when this is all over, you know, we're all going to have an opportunity to start anew. And so I'm looking forward to new beginnings.
Yeah, when you say that, Ricky, and you know, you said you feel like you found enough things, but is it really enough? I know the way your mind works, and you know, photography, and then it was this and that. And when I say that, I think some people like can't ever find themselves, and they go to one thing and the next. I feel like everything you take, it becomes a part of you. So it's not like you take on photography and then that's the flavor of the month and then it's gone from your life. Like that will always be, you'll always be a photographer, but now you'll always be an astrologer. So it's just wild that you just keep accumulating.
Yeah.
These.
You know, yeah, photography. You know, there are some things that were, in one sense, were fads, but in another sense, I have a greater appreciation for photography and photographers. And I look at the world now as a, you know, partially as a photographer. And so, you know, I'm not taking as many pictures as I was before, but that experience and those several years of really focusing on it really added to the depth of who I am as a person.
Yeah, literally.
But when I'm
through a different lens, right? Literally.
Exactly. That's a great metaphor. And but you know, now I feel like, you know, studying, you know, meditation and yoga, and these are things that you can do for the rest of your life, and you can keep getting better at and keep seeing rewards from it. And so I feel like I found things to study and to do that are going to be able to be rewarding for the rest of my life. And also, more importantly, they give me the ability to give back in meaningful ways.
That is awesome. I almost hate to shift gears, you know, and then actually go into football, but you know, because we do like to talk Dolphins, we'll talk a little bit about your football journey. The challenge we had was your journey is so rich and so decorated. It was kind of, you know, we couldn't talk about everything because I don't know that you have that much time to give. So obviously it makes sense for us, given the nature of this podcast and how we all know you, is to go back to 2002. And, yeah, you know, the Dolphins pull off this mega trade with the Saints, and it brings you here to South Florida. And we'll get to the football part of that. But talk about what that experience was like for you just as a person who the idea of, you know, everything that happened that the Saints gave up to get you to that franchise. And 3 years later, you're being traded. You're going to a new city. It's a fresh start. You're landing here in South Florida and all the different things that come with the South Florida lifestyle. I know you and I would always talk about being a Dade guy versus a Broward guy. Yeah. And Ricky, by the way, Juice, Ricky, and he had a 305 number. He was living in Fort Lauderdale, but he said, I'm a 305 guy, regardless of where my address is. But just what was that like for you as a person? The football stuff is easy.
Yeah.
He's breaking another one, by the way, behind you, Preach. But, well, you know, what was that experience like for you?
You know, it's one of my favorite things to talk about that I don't ever really get a chance to talk about, because I was at the crossroads in my life, 2002, and first 3 years in New Orleans were a lot of injuries, a new coach. It was rough, but I learned to really love the city. And I literally had gotten to the point where I made a decision that football wasn't a big deal for me as a Saint, that I was going to more focus my energy into using the platform as a football player to become more involved in the community in New Orleans. In my mind, I was thinking maybe going into politics. And because, you know, the Saints had drafted Deuce McAllister the year before, and, you know, so I could see the writing on the wall. So I was like, it's not a big deal. And around that time, I was going to the Bahamas to, the paid gig for the Super Bowl, 2002. And in the airport, on the way to the Bahamas, I ran into Dave Wannstedt in the airport.
Oh, wow.
and his wife. And we sat down, and I was like, hey, and we had a conversation. And I think in that moment, he saw that I was a real person and, you know, a kind person or whatever. He got a real life impression instead of what he'd heard about me. And, you know, a couple months later, I got a call from Randy Mueller, the GM of the Saints, telling me that a trade had been executed, and I was going to Miami. And it ruined my plans for politics in New Orleans, but I, you know, at the time, Dan Le Batard was probably my, you know, best friend in the world, and I had spent some time with Dan in Miami, and so it was exciting. I was, and it was a team that had a winning tradition, unlike the Saints, the team that had an amazing defense. I'd known Zach a little bit from Tech, and through Zach, I hung out with him and JT when I was in college in Miami. And so I knew some people on the team, and I was excited for the opportunity. And as soon as I got to Miami and I saw that I felt like I was a missing piece to a really amazing team, I felt like I was home. And embracing the lifestyle in Miami, I mean, goodness gracious. I can't help but smile. I mean, it just felt like all the three difficult years in New Orleans, that it was all the penance I had to pay to have this wonderful opportunity to show up in Miami. And it was so many little things just clicked, you know, my relationship with John Gamble. There's just so many, Joel Collier, there's so many amazing pieces of the puzzle that everything just came together in 2002 with the trade to Miami.
Yeah, you know, and let's talk about that a little bit, you know, how everything clicked. You know, on the field, we have to talk about it some, man, because you brought some shit down here, man, we've never seen before. You know, over 1,800 yards rushing, 16 up ends, you know what I mean? What made everything click? Why do you think everything clicked? The comfort level, feeling more at home, feeling appreciated, what made it click so much for you?
Yeah, I think it's match and fit, you know, and I think you can have a great football player go to a program where there's not a match or a fit and there's no magic. You can have a mediocre player go somewhere where there's just, they click in and they make it to the Pro Bowl. And I just think the mentality of the Miami Dolphins at that time, they were a physical team and they played defense, and that fit that. And even the way they played defense, that just fit right into who I was as a football player. And the fact that Norv Turner, who I think is probably the greatest mind when it comes to scheming an offensive run game, and also his ability to get into a rhythm of what his running backs like to run and calling plays, and then the way, you know, JT, Zach, and that whole defense just fall that year. It just, so many different things just came together at the right time.
Yeah, we're seeing some of them behind pre-share. It was a special season. I mean, it was I say special season. You know, I worked both seasons, your first two seasons there, and they were special. And it's funny, you just mentioned Joel Collier, and I knew you guys had a unique relationship. And Joel, you know, it's funny, Juice, Ricky was not the quote-unquote average football player. He was a different kind of guy. Joel probably was not the average football coach, real cerebral and different kind of personality and human in a lot of ways, not to disparage other coaches, but you know, there's a singular focus there sometimes required from the job. And so you guys obviously had a unique relationship, but Joel, one day he and I were having a conversation about you and talking about your play. And he said, man, do you know how smart Ricky is? I said, well, yeah, I've gotten pretty close with him. He's a really smart guy. He goes, no, you don't understand. So there's kind of an urban legend that you have a photographic memory. And I don't know if Joel started that, or I don't know if it's fact, but Joel said, Seth, he has never brought a pencil or a sheet of paper into a meeting. He sits there, he goes, the first couple of weeks, I was a little concerned. He has not had a mental bust yet this season. He has, you know, and so, like, is that real? Is that something that, you know, I know you like the mystery of Ricky and all those things, but I mean, do you have a photographic memory? Have you been your?
I think so. I think part of it is a photographic memory, but part of it, and I think it's lost on people, is how much I respect and love the game of football. And you know, when I played, even still, I catch myself. I think about it all the time. And so it's not like I just show up to the training facility and like start thinking about it. It's, you know, if we're playing the Patriots, I'm thinking about, you know, Richard Seymour and Teddy Bruschi and you know, Lawyer Malloy, whoever the safety, I'm thinking about that all the time. And so when I get into the meeting and I hear the coach's approach and their game plan, I'm trying to like vibe with it so that when I get in the game, I'm able to make the most of my opportunities. And so I just think, and I have a good memory because I love it and I'm engaged in it and I want this information.
It's got to be more than that though, man. Like, these things I love, but I got to write some shit down every now and then, Ricky. So, you know, and
no, I do have a photographic memory. I do.
Yeah. Well, there it is.
There it is.
You have to love what you're doing.
No doubt.
And I hate making mistakes. Like my goal every game was to play the perfect game. And yeah, I'm great out in the 90s, but always looking for that perfect game. Never got it, but always strived for it.
That's so cool. And so, and this, I had this in the notes later, but you brought up the fact that what is often lost from people is how much you really love the game of football. I think sometimes people, it was in a lot of ways ignorant, or it was low hanging fruit and kind of a lazy thought that you didn't love the game, or that other things were more important, or, you know, for all the things that we could go into later here, whether the way you retired the first time, or that you had all these outside interests that football players aren't supposed to have interests beyond football. And I remember, and I'm going to come back to this again later, but I remember when you did first come back and you had a charity event. And this was after the 2004 season, you were off and you had a big charity event. I don't forget where it was. It was some hotel in Miami, and kind of like trying to get in touch with you, man. I showed up and I had to like give my social security number and did all this. And Floyd had to like walk me up to the room, but I went up and I saw you in your room, and we were out on the balcony. I don't know if you remember this conversation. And you said one of the things that really hurt you was the fact that people, not that you were talented, but your passion for approaching the game and playing the game the right way, and how hard you practice, and how much every play mattered to you, that folks never seem to understand that. And so to hear you say that, it kind of brings me back to that moment.
Well, I think there's an assumption, and it's partially true, that to be in the NFL, and especially to be, you know, one of the best players, that you have to have natural born ability. And yes, But I think my greatest natural born gift is my attention to detail. And yeah, I'm you know, it's big, and I can accelerate, and I have, you know, a bruising kind of attitude. But I think to get the most out of those things, I think I had to, it was the attention to detail and the fact that I cared. And again, it's about love. And I had a love for the game. I had a love for my teammates. I had a respect for just the magic of so many guys getting together and having to be on the same page to execute something. And I think we train so hard and we do it so well that I think it doesn't connect. I don't think the fans can appreciate like how difficult it is to get 11 guys on the same page, you know? And there's a magic that happens in a season when you start clicking and everything is just working right. There's nothing like it. And so part of my love for the game was the love for those special moments when everyone is on the same page and things are just clicking. I was fortunate enough in Miami that we were a defensive team, you know, that had a running back. And that was the mentality, at least, of Dave. But that I got to be the star of the symphony. You know, I got to be the lead singer you don't see that very much, especially now from the running back position. And so, you know, I reflect on 2002. It's tragic. It was tragic the way it ended, but I reflect on what we did accomplish, and it's amazing. It's wonderful.
Yeah, Eric, you know, and there's every guy on the roster in 02, 03, you know, they probably have amazing and crazy stories and good stories about Ricky Williams, but you mentioned a couple guys that you played with as well that may have had an impact on you too. Who are some of the guys, you talk about JT and Zach and those guys, who are those guys, and tell me what impact they might have had on you and why they had such an impact?
You know, I think the person who had the biggest impact on me was Jamie Nails.
Big Nails.
Big Nails.
Yeah, man, I can see you and Big Nails running down the sideline right now with your hand on his back, man. That was great stuff.
No, just his attitude. Like, he just came to work every day, and it was fun, you know, and as hard as we work to be with guys that are out there having fun, to me, that's what it's all about. And I can go through the whole offense. And I just think when an offense is that successful, and everyone cares about each other. You know, Ray Lucas, like, inspiring. You know, he came in a couple rough starts, and then he got in his groove, and he was playing great football. You know, Chris Chambers, just making magic, man. So,
yeah, buddy.
One of the most kindest, talented, you know, and he made it look so easy. You know, so easy. Tim Ruddy, you know, going over his house, you know, meeting his kids, having dinner with his, we just had a bunch of good guys that enjoyed playing football together. And the defensive guys, just their attitude and the way they played defense, that had an impact on us. You know, we knew no matter what happened, they were going to go out there and get a stop. It was like what I loved about Miami. It was success was expected. It just was, we breathed it. It just was the expectation, the way we did everything, that we were going to be successful.
That was one of my favorite seasons right there, man. You know, as after I retired, you know, sitting, first of all, the trade itself, the trade itself, getting our dub on the team, honestly, I thought that was a dream. There's no way that was really happening. We were getting our dub on the team. And then that put our dub with that defense. I mean, that was some fun shit for me, man. I look back at that as a fan. And I had season tickets in the first row. You know what I mean? You was running into my end zone a lot. You know, I love that shit so much. Man, that was good stuff, bro.
Those were good times. And, you know, talk about a lot of oscillation here between on and off the field, Ricky. And one of the things that was very early apparent to me and certainly wasn't some new revelation that I came up with, but you are truly an individual. You know, you embrace your individuality. You're unapologetically Ricky. And a lot of folks like to judge you in different ways. And that never stopped. You might have been bothered from time to time, but it never stopped you from being you. And, you know, 20 years ago, that was a tough pill for people to swallow. What I'm wondering is how much was it a challenge for you to hang on to that individuality in this world where, you know, you kind of used another analogy, but that's an environment that's probably more about making machines than works of art, you know, in the football world. So how hard was it for you to hang on to that individuality? And then the second part of the question is, do you think that today's NFL is more accepting of individuality than the one you played in almost 20 years ago?
I mean, they let them dance now. So
that's a fair point.
No, of course it's more accepting. You know, when I, my 1 year, my last year in Baltimore, and very grateful for that year because it was around a veteran organization, you know, with Ray Lewis and Ed Reed there and Harbaugh, just a player's coach. And I remember one meeting, it was before a game, and he said, you know, my message to all of you guys is to let your light shine. And that organization, they really push the guys to be individuals. And they realize that if we have a bunch of individuals working together as a team, we're going to be better than if we're a machine. And so was it hard to hold on to it? It wasn't hard to hold on to it because I knew that trying to be someone else didn't work. And I was talented enough that I was given the space to be an individual, which made it easier. What was difficult was not being appreciated by people. You know, it was my teammates and the people who saw the way that I worked and took the time to get to know me and understand me as much as they could. They appreciated me, you know, but it was difficult, you know, sometimes with the media. And I even think for the most part, I think fans appreciated me, but I just think sometimes, you know, I didn't, and that's the whole thing about being an individual, right? Is if someone's an individual, it takes time to learn to appreciate them. If someone is a machine, it's easy to appreciate them because there's something familiar about it. And so I just think the burden of being someone who's an individual and being ahead of your time is that you're not going to be appreciated until later. And I'm starting to experience that now. And it's worth it. You know,
it's worth it now.
Yeah. It was hard. It was hard as hell. It was challenging. It was difficult. But I think when you're young, you know, you have the energy to create and deal with so much drama. And I look at my time in Miami and I grew up so much, you know, I have so much gratitude for all the people that I've met. And I just feel so fortunate that I got to grow up so much in such a special place, you know. And just, you know, just seeing how the retired players, the former players are still so much a part of the community. And it truly feels like a family. And every time I'm back in Miami and doing anything connected to the Dolphins, I feel that family feeling. It's wonderful.
That's awesome.
It is.
That is awesome. The Dolphins do. And Juice, you know, you're very involved with the alumni and that. And but the Dolphins do a great job with what for you to say that and acknowledge that. And you hear so many players say that, and especially players who have perspectives from other cities, is that they really do embrace their alumni here, which is great for us with this show because that's what we're all about.
Yeah. There's I mean, always I talked to my wife about this. If we ever, you know, left and we're moving somewhere else, my first choice is we're going back down to Miami.
Is that her first choice, though?
Yeah. She's open to it. She's definitely open to it. Yeah.
Well, you know, we'd love to have you back in town.
I didn't know my quality of life in Miami would be great. You know, every time I come back, people are so appreciative. The ups and the downs. Like, I truly feel like I'm a lifetime Miami Dolphin.
You are.
You moved today, not Broward, though, I'm assuming.
It'd be, yeah, I'm sorry. It'd be Jade.
So I'm going to tell a little story here, Juice, and I'll see how much of this Ricky remembers. And I've always wanted to ask you this. So 2004, June of 2004, 2004, that time period was a big time period for you, but it also was for me. And yeah. And I think you know where I'm going with this. So June of 2004, yeah. JT offers me a job. I'd worked for the Dolphins for 8 years. And he offers me a job. He has this idea of starting a foundation 16 years later. It's crazy. I'm still running the foundation. And that vision has gotten us to where we are. But I took the job before I could even get back to my seat. I asked Harvey if I could email everybody. And Harvey had already emailed the whole league and said he was looking for a new bird. You know, so I didn't even get a chance to tell my story. But I'm sure it doesn't surprise you. But I did want to tell the guys. And so I went to the locker room. And there were certain guys that, you know, at that point, guys were coming in and working out. And I think we might have had some sort of off-season camp. And so I sat down with Ricky Juice and I told him, I said, I was leaving. And he goes, wow. And he said, that's terrible. He goes, no, it's great for you. He said, it's not great for me. And then we talked and then you asked me, I don't know if you remember this conversation, but you said, why are you leaving? And I told you that my whole dream, my whole life was to work for the Dolphins and I had achieved it and I had accomplished that dream. And now it was time for me to do something else and to spread my wings and to find that next thing. And I'll never feel any regret because I had achieved that dream. And you looked at me and like, you got it. Like that really clicked with you. And then like two weeks later, you're calling me for Travis Miner's phone number. And then you're texting me for Dave's phone number. And I'm like, so I've always wanted to talk to you. I mean, there's a lot of factors that led to you making the decision that you made.
But and was that like, was one of them. Yes.
I carried a little burden there.
Yeah, you should. It's your fault. Seriously. Right. You know, it was one of those things where in life, sometimes you have to make really difficult decisions. But I felt like leading up to my decision to retire, there are so many little hints, so many conversations, so many things pushing me in that direction. And you know, hearing you tell that story, yes, it had a lot to do. And I'm being serious.
Great.
It had a lot to do. It was just another sign pushing me in that direction. And it helped me realize that I did have a dream to accomplish certain things as a football player. And I had accomplished those things. And I was ready for my life to get bigger. And I was fortunate enough, and as you were, is that I got to come back in a year later and finish my career and do all the things that I wanted to do. And it all worked out.
I don't know how to take it.
Oh. Man, I'm so mad at you, Big Seth, man. I'm so pissed off, man. Damn.
Yeah, thanks for fucking it up, Seth.
Nah, I know. We said we were blaming the wrong person, R-Dub. Oh.
I don't even have a jersey that people can burn, so I don't know what's going to happen to this podcast after this thing. But I'd always wonder, because when I said it, and like, you know, you see a look in somebody's eyes, like they really understand what you're telling them. And he's like, yeah. Like, I said, you know what I mean? He's like, yeah, I actually do know what you mean. But when he called me for T-Mo, I didn't think, when you called me for Travis's number, I didn't think anything of it. But then when you called me the next day for Dave, I was like, oh, shit, this thing could be going sideways fast. What was that conversation like? You know, I don't know if you've got a story, but how hard was that?
You know, it started off hard. And first, before I throw into the story, first time that I saw Dave since that conversation, actually, or even before that conversation, was at the Super Bowl this past year.
Yeah, I was there.
Yeah, exactly. And so the conversation started off as being difficult, but it got easy kind of fast, you know, and I called him up and I said, hey coach, you know, I said, I've been really feeling like it's time for me to do something different in my life and go a different direction. And, you know, I was out of the blue. And again, a couple of weeks before training camp. So I'm sure he was like, what the hell? And, you know, Dave is great, but he's not known for thinking quick on his feet all the time, you know? And so what he said to me was, he said, if I were your father, I'd tell you something different. And at that moment, it got really easy because I lost respect for him, you know, is that it was difficult. And I don't blame him. It's difficult to put yourself in to be a coach where there's implications that might cause you your job and actually seeing someone as a young man, as a human being. And I don't blame him, but, you know, so I was like, all right. And the next conversation, so that conversation ended and, you know, at the end, he said, I respect you. I understand whatever you have to do. But our next conversation was a couple months later after I retired. I was in Australia and I got on the phone with him and Rick Spielman. And I was trying to explain to them my rationale and explain to them why I decided to retire. And one of the issues was I was in the midst of a contract negotiation. And, you know, I'm naive. I'll own that. Is I think if there's a player who's proven that they're willing to put their guts, their heart on the line and play, and you're going to give them the ball 400 times a year, that you should go out of your way to take care of that person. They shouldn't have to like beg you for scraps. And so I told them in that second conversation, I said, one of the reasons I retired is because I felt like you guys weren't doing a good job taking care of me and making me feel good about sacrificing my body for the team. You know, I said I was a player that complained the least about anything on the team. And I was hurt that they didn't understand. I can understand that I retired and, you know, the season was kind of up in the air. But that hurt.
Up in the air. Holy shit.
Yeah.
That was rough. Yeah.
Let me tell you about, you know, when I saw Dave and Rick at the Super Bowl, me and Dave and a couple other guys already, and JT was already in there in an appearance that we were at. And somebody runs in there and they says, "Hey, Dave, you know, Ricky's here." And Juan's like, "Oh shit." Like basically that's, like, he was worried. He said, and he was like, "But he's happy to see you." He said, "Really? Like he's happy to see me?" You know what I mean? So that's when those two had seen each other for the first time since that happened. And, you know, just hear those two talk, man, and hear them be able to hash that out a little bit, you know, you tell there's like no hard feelings. And of course, Juan's like Ricky said, Juan's was sitting there. Juan said that 63% of their offense retired on him 2 weeks before training camp. You know what I mean? So that's a hell of a number right there that he regurgitated that fast. Of course, that's on the line. You know what I mean? So, yeah, it was a rough one for him.
Yeah. So that was very healing for me because he went out of his way to apologize and say, you know, he said, "I realized the mistake that cost me my job was that I didn't respect the quarterback position enough." Things that were rumors, he admitted them. You know, he said, if Jay threw two incompletions or anything that would scare me of a pick, I would get on.
That's right. That's right.
Ignore him and say, "Uh-uh."
Run.
Run, Ricky, run.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Man, so
it was great to see him. It was great. Yeah.
So needless to say, Rick, it was absolute chaos when you left. You left, Dave resigns, you know, the team goes 4-12, and you know, we as fans were losing our damn minds, man.
I could only imagine.
When you were gone, did you follow football at all after that, or do you follow the team at all? And talk about that journey once you left and what it meant for you to be able to do that. We were hurting, but I think you might have been in a more of a peaceful place yourself.
I was. Yeah. So, you know, my intent really after I retired was to get it far away from football as I possibly could, you know, and because I realized that who I was at that point in my time had been almost 100%, you know, based on me as a football player, and I wanted to get a sense of who I was outside of that. And so I went to a country where there was no, you know, people didn't watch football, and I went to places where no one had any idea who I was. And, you know, it was nice to get away, but at the same time, I also in some way started to learn to appreciate the game on a deeper level and to appreciate everything that the game of football had given me in my life. And I don't just mean financial resources. I mean, I tell people this. I say, thinking about, you know, creating leaders, there's nothing like the training in college and professional football to prepare us to be leaders, you know, having to work as a team, having to get hit in the mouth and get up in 40 seconds and remember a play and execute again. It just prepares you for life, that we all get knocked down, but our ability to hop up and shake it off and go back at it again, nothing more valuable than that. And I appreciated, because it was funny. That year off, I became a yoga instructor. And I went to India, and we had this intensive and four-week yoga training. Up at 6, you know, meditate, yoga, 4 hours a day. And everyone was complaining about it. And I was like, you know what? This feels exactly like training camp. I just realized how playing football really prepared me to do all the things that I want to do in life. That's what I learned. And so when I came back after that year off, I approached football. I was a better football player. I was a better person. I was a better teammate. And I was more appreciative of the opportunity.
So talking about coming back, and I'd mentioned it earlier that, you know, I'm going to go back to that hotel room on that balcony where we were talking. And the other big thing, when you, not just that you would come back and everything else, but for, you know, it was a major, major thing was was your hair or lack thereof, right? And and it's wild now because everybody has, you know, there's so many guys with dreads, like it's so commonplace, but nobody had them, and you had been so identifiable with and tied to your hair in so many ways, and we had talked about that, and I hope you'll share some of that with us here. But one of the things you said to me was that when you cut your hair, there was no mirror, there was no, you know, you were just, I don't know if it was a tent or wherever you were, and you just kind of cut it without looking, and hadn't seen, you didn't even see yourself for maybe a week after or whatever that was. And just Ricky said that he literally got scared of his own shadow because he looked at, so, you know, tell us about that. Cause I remember you, and I'll never forget that. Cause that was so profound.
Wow. Yeah. That was an intense experience. So I was in Australia, and I bought an old Volkswagen bus. And when I bought it, there was a bed in the back, and there was like a sink, and there was a crate that had stuff in it. And one of the things in the crate were a pair of scissors. And so I was in the Blue Mountains right outside of Sydney, a national park.
Who knows whose damn scissors those were?
and I was taking pictures, and I was doing self portraits, and I was looking at myself, and I just was overcome by this need for a change. You know, again, realized that I had been identified as something that I felt trapped in. And so I just got inspired, and I ran up this mountain to where my car was parked. And I went in the back and got those scissors and started grabbing handfuls of dreads and cut my hair. And it was very liberating, you know, and I was in Australia. So no one that saw me would know. They'd just be like, there's just another black guy in Australia. So I got in my car, and I had a good friend of mine named Jane, who was an athletic trainer in Texas, who I knew lived in Brisbane. And so I got in my car and I drove to Brisbane, and I went to her house, and my hair looked horrible because it was scissors, so it was blotchy. And so I went into her house, and she like looked at me, and she was like, "You look different."
You think?
So the next day I got up and I went to Kmart. They have Kmart in Australia, and I bought a pair of clippers, and I finished the job. And it was trippy. It was trippy. I mean, I started growing dreads when I was 15 years old. And so this was the first time as an adult that I looked different. And even my profile or my shadow or the reflection in a window, it scared me a little bit. I didn't recognize the person I was looking at, and just the gravity of such a big change. And I'm glad I did it in another country, and it gave me time to get used to it. Because even a couple, you know, weeks later when I came back to Miami, like everyone's reaction for the first 3 months was like, what the?
Not, hey, it's great to see you. It's just, holy shit, look at your head.
Yes, exactly. And you know, and in a way, again, this was right before I retired. In a way, it was a wake-up call to realize that I've been identified as something that I don't, I feel like I'm growing out of. And I feel like I needed to cut my hair. I needed that year off to find myself. And again, I was lucky enough that, you know, when Nick Saban came in, he said, I want Ricky. So I had an opportunity to come back and right the ship and leave on a high note.
He's going to get it in there at some point, wasn't he?
You know, it's funny you say that because, you know, we've heard you talk about so much about how, you know, football, especially pro football, is regimented. And, you know, and Saban has a reputation, of course, of being, you know, this ultimate taskmaster. So what was your relationship like with him, you know, and him bringing you back?
I mean, he's one of my favorite people in the whole entire world. I know a lot of people in Miami have mixed feelings about him. But I, from a football perspective, you know, he didn't mess around. He knew, he was so clear on what it took to be a champion and what it took to win. And that's all that he admitted. And to be around that, it made me a better football player. I mean, it made me a better person. And there are certain things about Nick, I'm telling you, because I was suspended for the first 4 games of that year. And so I thought I just would be chilling for 4 weeks, you know? And he called me into his office and he said, you know, he said, I think it would be a good idea if after the team finished practicing, you went out on the field and you had your own personal practice, you know? Wow. He had a way of asking you to do stuff where you just were like, okay. And so every day after the guys finished practicing, I'd go out there with Ben, and he would give me 40 carries. I'd catch 20 balls, run through the cones. And I had a practice, and it got me right. It got me ready. His whole thing was, if you go out there and you bust your ass and you play smart, that's all I care about. And that I could play for a coach like that any day.
You know, Seth, I don't know how many times you got a chance to, if you got any chance to see Ricky practice, man. But Ricky practiced like it was a game situation. You know, every time he touched the rock, he was scoring with it. You know, a lot of guys, you know, go 10, 15 yards. Rick's trying to get to the end zone every single time. And that's why you see him in games. You know, we're watching some of those clips behind Priest. And he's running away from DBs and waving at them. That was some of the funniest shit I ever seen, man. It's like waving at some of these DBs and running away from them. Because that's how he worked, man. That's how he practiced, man. And that shit becomes contagious on a team, man. It was just it was fun to watch. And that's how he approached the game.
Ronnie talked about it. And this is not the Ronnie story that we're going to
– Yeah, I want to hear about this Ronnie story.
We're going to get to that Ronnie story in a minute. But the one of the things that OJ just said, where you would every carry, even if it was, you know, I don't know the plays, but you would take everything 40, 50 yards. And Ronnie said, because that 05 was his rookie year, right? And he was watching that. And he's like, damn, I can't, you know, I'm first round pick. I thought I could chill, but Ricky ain't going to let me chill out here. You really had an impression upon him in that setting there. But we're going to get to that other story. Well, actually, you know what? So this is part of it. You had three different stints with the Dolphins, essentially, and a whole lot of coaches. And you know, Nick had his own departure, and that's another story for another show. But under the next regime, 2008, well, 2007, as much as it sucks to get injured, Lawrence Timmons might have done you a little bit of a favor. After being too much a part of that shit show. But in 2008, The Wildcat was born, and Ronnie kind of told us from his perspective of what that was like for you and him and Patrick Cobbs to sit in that running back room and have that thing drummed up. And so I would love to know from your side what that was like in that moment and why you didn't grab the quarterback position and just kind of how that thing came to be.
Yeah. So first of all, David Lee came over from Arkansas, and with McFadden and Felix Jones, they ran it at Arkansas. They ran the Wildcat at Arkansas. And so we were in the middle of training camp, and David Lee got up and introduced the Wildcat. And as he was introducing the Wildcat, I was sitting there and I was like, what is this high school shit? You know, and I said, I'm the old guy, so I'm probably not even gonna be on this package. And so I just kind of like started to ignore it. And then he put it up on the board and he said that, Ricky, you're gonna be the Wildcat. You're gonna be the guy going in motion. Then I was like, I guess I better pay attention. And it was kind of one of those things where we just thought it's something that they put in and we kind of do it in practice, but we're not ever going to do it in a game. And we had fun with it. And I think what people don't realize is every single day that year in our walkthrough, which was, you know, half an hour, all we did was Wildcat. That's all we did every day. And so we put a lot of time into it and we got really good at it. And so we start the season and, you know, it doesn't start off well. And we're going up to Foxborough and we kind of have nothing. And so that week they install the Wildcat. And we're kind of excited because we've been working on it in practice. And we're like, we're going to see how it goes in real life. And then we went up to Foxborough and we ran it. And the beautiful thing about that is the Patriots, you know, they're always so prepared, you know. And to see them like running into each other and being unprepared and yelling at each other on the sidelines, it was beautiful. And they didn't know what to do. And we just whooped up on them. And that felt so good. But like what you touched on, and I think is the most important part of it, was, and it was also Lusaka was in on there too. So we had four running backs, four guys from our running back room on the field at the same time. And it helped us grow really close. And it's a good feeling when the coaches put so much of the offense in one room. And we loved it. And it, like I said, it brought us all closer and we had a chance to make big impacts in a lot of games.
And the Patriots are the perfect team to put it against, because you know as well as anybody that if it's on tape, they're going to be ready for it. And it hadn't been on tape. So it was like perfect moment. So the coaching genius behind that is pretty awesome as well.
Yeah. And the other thing was Ronnie and I split time, and Pete Copps, a good football player, you know, amazing on special teams, but also he did a lot of wonderful things on offense. So it just gave us all a chance to be on the field at the same time. And I think it revitalized my career for sure.
Wow.
Ronnie also told us another story, man, back in the day about a little trip to Bakersfield, California. He was when he was in doing a Joey Porter football camp. Yeah, see where I'm going, Ray?
Oh my God. I just don't know how much of the story he told, but I will say it was an experience like that where that Ronnie and I really grew close to each other. You know, a lot of times when you have two guys playing the same position and competing for time and carries, that it can turn into a lot of animosity. But we worked out together, we hung out together, we practiced hard together, and it was, you know, I consider Ronnie in all my time as a professional football player as being probably my best friend, and still to this day, you know, he made doing something very difficult like playing football, he made it a lot of fun.
Yeah, he said the same, I believe, too. But he also said that, you know, you kind of passed out in the lobby and he had to carry your big ass back to your room. And so, you know, I got the same situation. I got some kids, you know, and I know when we go on a long road trip, get out of the car, you know, they're sleeping. I know they're not asleep. They just want me to carry their ass. Did you just want Ronnie to carry your big ass around the hotel, man? Is that what it was?
I mean, I don't drink very much, but when I drink. And so... I remember being in the car, and then I remember waking up the next morning.
He tucked you in and everything. It sounds like he got
he
you.
Did. Oh no, he just threw me. He opened the door and just pushed me into the room. You know, because I was like,
hey, we'll have to send you the audio of his side of the story.
I mean, he just opened the door and pushed me because I woke up. I was on top of the ironing board. My clothes were off.
We'll let you hear it from Ronnie himself, but it sounded like walking around. He said he had you like fireman's carry walking around. And the best part was he didn't want to go back downstairs. So he's calling the guy at the, you know, he found one of those phones and he was calling. He's like, can you help me find Ricky's room? This dude is heavy.
I love it. That's what friends are for, huh?
I guess so. You know, it's funny. You talk about how close friends you guys were. And I never thought about it, but you talked about the mentality that you have. Juice, have you ever met two guys who were more mild-mannered as human beings, but just nasty and physical in that running back position? It's kind of – that dichotomy is crazy.
Yes, nasty. Those boys, man, they – you know, Ricky and Ronnie, man, it's like, you know, Bell Bib DeVoe-like, you know. Them boys, man, they were filthy out there. And really, like Ricky talked about them splitting times and Pete Cobb's getting some – every once in a while getting an opportunity. I mean, you couldn't prepare for both of those dudes, man. I mean, both of them ran with violence, you know. Both of them ran with speed. I mean, that was a hell of a combination. And I've talked to Ricky a few times, man. And I've told Ricky. And Ronnie could have – you know, Ronnie would have been here maybe longer – you know, I feel the same way about him being such a great running back. But Ricky's the best running back the Miami Dolphins have ever seen. And I've told Ricky that. There's not, I don't care what they say. Anybody can have their little, you know, the guys in the 70s. Ricky's the best running back the Dolphins have ever had, period.
Thank you. It means a lot.
That's the one thing. I'm not a person that has a lot of regrets, but I do regret that I didn't finish my career in Miami. I think one more year I would have become the Miami Dolphins all-time leading rusher. And that would have been, I mean, I'm not a huge fat guy, but that would have been significant for me to literally leave my mark on such a storied program.
I think, Rick, I still think carries in you, man. I think you still have some carries in you. You want to come back and finish that out because, hey, Seth, I was telling you, I was playing in a little bit of a, I guess it was a charity game where we're playing Wounded Warriors versus some NFL. Yeah. Guys, and Rick was playing with the Wounded Warrior guys, and Rick was running hard as hell. I'm like, this dude, I mean,
I can't help it.
I'm not grabbing that flag. I'm
right here. That switch just flips, huh, Ricky?
I'm telling you, I was just, when I went to the Pro Bowl, they're in the middle of the game, the defensive guys were telling me, stop running so hard. It's an exhibition game.
Only know one way. I love it.
Yeah.
So, Juice, this has been kind of trippy. Like, I don't think we've had a guest that has segued us into each question. We haven't sent Ricky the show notes, but I mean, he brought up Nick Saban for the Nick Saban question. Ronnie, you have really teed us up for each one of these, so we appreciate that.
Of course.
Yeah, it's kind of scary. But, you know, you talked about not being a stat guy and being the Dolphins, how close you were to being the Dolphins' all-time leading rusher. We are now in a time period where you are seeing the running backs of your era either get nominated for or close to the Hall of Fame or now are being inducted in. You know, Edge now is going in. And if you look at stats across the board, and again, you know, stats are stats and there's a lot of different ways to tell the story. But where do you see yourself amongst those guys? Is the Hall of Fame something you even, I hate to say you don't care because I don't want to make it sound callous, but is that something that you even concern yourself with? Do you feel that Ricky Williams belongs in the Hall of Fame?
You know, the moment I decided to retire in 2004, I gave up on my any Hall of Fame aspirations. And to even be, from that point on, even to be considered, and I think it was a big deal that I was able to rush for 10,000 yards in my career in 11 seasons, especially considering one of those seasons was only 6 carries in a torn pec. So I feel good, and that's what's important. I feel good about the work that I left on the field. You know, I feel really good about that. Whether getting me the Hall of Fame or not, like, that'd be great. I think it'd be a testament, but I don't lose any sleep over it. You know, I imagine, you know, in 30 years when the new writers, the sports writers are looking at old film and they're like, that William guy was pretty good. Maybe we should consider him after everyone has kind of forgotten all the more edgy parts of my story. Who knows? What I tell myself, though, a lot of it I think will have to do with what I do with my life after football. Mm-hmm. I think if I make a name for myself, it's the best I can do to make my case.
Well, I think, having Levitard in your corner is a good voice for you, too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Talk about stuff on him.
As long as you're not trying to get in the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Exactly right, man. But that's good stuff, man. You know, let's pretty much closing out, man. What a great interview, man. And just seeing you, Rick, and hear you talk, man, and smile and enjoy, you know, where you're at right now. But let's talk about where you're at a little bit more. Let's talk about Leela a little bit. What is Leela, and talk a little bit about what you're doing, your business endeavors.
Yeah, so a whole nother element of when I retired in 2004 is that I traveled the world and I learned a whole bunch of interesting new things, you know. And so when I came back for my second and third stint with the Dolphins, people don't know this, but I'd be on the team plane with my little computer getting everyone's birth information, you know, so I can look at their astrological chart. And it's been a passion of mine, you know, for 16 years now. And as I've had more time to really dive into it, I see that it can be very helpful to people. And I think one area of life where everyone can use a little bit of help is relationships, whether that's meeting people or making relationships work. And I found that astrology can be very helpful. And so, you know, combining my experience with the help of one of my teachers and just modern technology right now in dating apps, finding a way to combine the two to give people astrological insights to help them meet people and make relationships work. And it seems like more people, especially the younger generation, are really starting to get into astrology. Seems like the time is right. And so I've been putting a lot of my energy and focus into getting this project up and going.
I'll hear from Ricky, you know, probably every year to 18 months, Juice, and I'll find out about the next project. You know, there was a football league at one point. There was, you know,
no, the football league still, you know, what's funny about the football league is, you know, we had two big competitors, you know, and both of them filed bankruptcy. And so it's really, and they've done a lot of the hard work for us because they've proved the concept and they've made mistakes that we can learn from. And so it's, right. You know, that project actually is picking
up. So it's still going.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. Cause I look back at the text. I don't know if the number I have is still a good one, but I look back in the
probably
last
not.
Text. Yeah. I wasn't banking on it. So we'll have to talk about that.
Oh my Lord.
Man, you know what else, Seth, we have to talk about a little bit is like, I would have never thought in a million years that I would see our dub on like Celebrity Apprentice and Big Brother. What went into that decision? Like what? I mean, I loved it. I'm not an apprentice guy, but
yeah.
I watched you on Big Brother, man. You killed it on Big Brother. That was
yeah. Awesome. Yeah. Two different situations. The first one was Apprentice came up and I was really, you know, thinking about post football getting into business, you know, and I felt like this would be a good opportunity to be able to get a quick, you know, course on business and marketing. And it seemed like a good opportunity. So an opportunity to raise money for a charity that I'm really passionate about. And I was so close, but Leela Ali, man. Anyways, so.
Yeah, I mean, when her last name is Ali, you might want to take
She knocked me. She knocked me out. I mean, yeah. Anyways, don't get me started. But then Big Brother came up and it was just one of those things where I've only seen one episode of Big Brother ever. And I remember watching it on television and thinking to myself, I would never do anything like that ever. And so when they reached out to me and they asked me, I had to like, eat, you know, put my foot in my mouth and say, this seems very interesting And it was just interesting enough that I said, I'm going to give it a try. And it was totally out of character. You know, first of all, hanging out with celebrities, especially those kinds of celebrities, and locked in a house like that for 30 days. But I had a blast. And I was lucky that there are athletes in there. And so I got really close with Lolo Jones. And I have to tell you, Tamar Braxton is the funniest person I have ever met in my whole entire life. I wouldn't have survived if it wasn't for her. She is just so naturally funny that she had us laughing. Even when she was yelling at us, she had us laughing the whole time. Oh my gosh, she is so funny. So I had a blast. I had a blast.
Well, we had a blast with you here today, man. We had wanted to get you on the show for some time, and I'm really appreciative that you said, you know, for the show's sake, that you were willing to do this. But I don't know that we've spent this kind of time together in 15, 16 years. So
yeah, it's been a while.
This was great. I appreciate you, man.
Yeah, I mean, I could go for another 2 hours. I'm sure.
Well, let's go. Well, it means we'll just have to bring it back.
Sequel.
Yeah. Seriously, please. I'd love to come back.
It'd be great.
Thanks for diving in, Rick, man. We appreciate it, man.
Of course. Yeah, thank you.
You're now diving into the fish tank.
Sitting down with Seth Living, OJ, Juice Man, ooh, and this is strictly for them true fans, dog fans, number one. Of course, y'all, this ain't no ordinary sports talk. Dive up in that fish tank. Go get your aqua orange. Yeah, it's time to dive up in that fish tank. It's only legendary talking when you dive up in that fish tank. Rocking with OJ and Seth when we dive up in that fish tank. Fans with attitude, we okay, got the devil for them diehards. Celebrate big or cry hard. Leave it all on the field, we gon' try hard. Old school, a new school, mix it in. Feeling like we up close when we listening. Dolphins tails in Miami is the deep end. We vibing with our favorite players, no secret. We get with Seth and McDuffie, bringing up stories we never heard to the public. Bet we love it, Dolphins fans never budget. We loyal to the team, whether happy or we upset. We be like, what's next? Don't switch the subject. You know it's all about them fins. And if you ready for that water, time to dive in. Don't switch the subject. You know it's all about them fins. And if you down with Dolphins Nation, time to dive in. Don't switch the subject. You know it's all about them fins. You looking at that fish tank, it's time to dive in. Fish tank. Go get your aqua orange. Yeah, it's time to dive up in that fish tank. It's only legendary talking when you dive up in that fish tank. Rapping with OJ and Seth when you dive up in that fish tank. Dog fans with attitude, we about to dive up in that fish tank.